Monster Talk is supported by listeners like you. Find out how you can contribute via Patreon or with reviews at monstertalk.org/support. Your contributions, large or small, make a huge difference. Thanks. When I think about haunted houses, I usually think of decaying old buildings, homes bent with age and held together as much by legend as by wood, plaster, and old nails. But in the heart of Washington, D.C., the residence of the President of the United States is as full of legends as it is of politicians. History and lore mingle to paint colorful pictures of a house which stands so starkly white.
Quite unlike anything we've ever seen before.
A giant hairy creature, part ape, part man.
In Loch Ness, a 24-mile-long bottomless lake in the highlands of Scotland, it's a creature known as the Loch Ness Monster.
Monster Talk.
Welcome to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith.
And I'm Karen Stolzner.
Have no fear. I mean, you can be afraid of ghosts if you like, but we're not going to talk about politics tonight. We're going to be talking about the residence of the United States presidents and many legends around it. I do need to make a note about the sound quality in this episode, or at least in the interview portion. Thanks to the generous support of patrons, I've been able to purchase some new equipment to get better sound quality, but somehow when I set this episode up, my audio was incorrectly set to use the laptop microphone instead of the lovely expensive microphone I normally talk into. I believe Karen and Lindsay both sound fine, but despite my best efforts, my audio settings, they sound poor. So my apologies, but on the bright side, Karen and Lindsay do most of the talking in this episode. So let's head on down Pennsylvania Avenue, past the fences and security guard, and into the White House for some
Monster Talk.
So a couple of things to get out of the way, bookkeeping-wise. Your name's Lindsay Chervinsky, is that right?
That's right.
Okay,
yep.
Super. All right. And Lindsay, we don't really have a bio for you. So can you tell us a little bit about who you are and your job?
Sure. So I am a White House historian for the White House Historical Association, which means that it's my job to share history about the White House and the people that have lived there and worked there and built the space and all of the things that have sort of happened in and around the White House and what it has meant to American culture. Prior to starting this job, I had a postdoctoral fellowship at the Center for Presidential History at Southern Methodist University. And then prior to that, I received my PhD in early American history at the University of California, Davis. And my specialty is actually on political institutions, especially in the early republic. I have recently completed a book on the creation of the president's cabinet, in particular in George Washington's administration. And so that will be out next year. So I'm really excited about that. And that's a little bit of my backstory.
Is your book available for pre-order yet or anything?
Not yet, unfortunately. I'm dying to see what the cover ends up looking like. It will be out with Harvard University Press in probably March of 2020.
I know. Wonderful. Karen's been through that before with the books.
So. Yeah, a number of times. And it's certainly very exciting when you see that cover for the first time. And with a few books, I've actually, even going through publishers, had to design my own covers, which is an interesting experience too.
Yeah, I can imagine. I think they'll probably take the lead, but I'm very curious to see what they come up with. They've done really great things in the past, so I trust them, but I'm very anxious for it.
Well, I have one more sort of presidential question. I we'll probably have many, but so you mentioned cabinet, but that terminology came later, right? I'm trying to remember which president had it. Was it Roosevelt? Who introduced the whole kitchen cabinet, or the cabinet as the name of the people who came in and
Yeah. So the cabinet, the term cabinet actually came from Britain.
Oh, really?
And,
okay.
Yeah. So cabinet initially referred to a small room off of sort of the main chambers of the king's meeting space. And so he would take his sort of favorite ministers into the king's cabinet, which was like a small little closet off the main room. And it was their private meeting space. And so it became known as the cabinet council. And then it just became known as the cabinet. And so that language was actually brought over. And Washington held his first cabinet meeting on November 26th, 1791, which was 2.5 years into his presidency, and by 1793, people were referring to it as the cabinet. So the language was brought over pretty quickly and given to Washington's cabinet pretty quickly. The interesting thing about that, I think, though, is Washington himself refused to use that word during his presidency. And so nowhere in his papers is the word cabinet. He either referred to them as the secretaries or the gentlemen of my family, because he considered the secretaries to be his official family. I'm doing air quotes, official family. And so he refused to use that word, but he knew that that's what other people were calling it, because the minute he retired, he referred to it as John Adams' cabinet. So he was very astute about what was going on. My best guess is that he didn't want it to be compared to the British cabinet, and so that's why he didn't use that language. But he never wrote down why he didn't, so that's kind of speculation.
Yeah, interesting.
Yeah, it is. He seemed really big on not being compared to a king.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, so Washington was so much more politically astute than people give him credit for, and he was very emotionally intelligent about the people around him and public opinion. And so he was very careful about when he was crafting his public persona. He was trying to find a mix between sort of the gravitas and the fanciness that was required to establish the United States on an international stage and be respectable among, you know, all of these international players and garner their respect. But also he understood that the American people wanted him to be a virtuous Republican, and that's little r Republican. So, for example, when he was thinking about his inauguration the first time, he ordered an American homespun suit. It was very good quality homespun, but it was American homespun as opposed to British wool or silk or anything like that. And then to, you know, give it a little bit of flash, he had diamond shoe buckles. So he liked to balance things out that way.
This is so interesting. We could do an entire show on Washington, I think.
So many. I could talk about him for hours.
Well, the reason that, or how we came up with this idea for this show was that I came across an article in the Washington Post that was about the White House being haunted. And so we got in contact with you, and we're very pleased to be able to have you on the show today. So with this background in history, how did you come to be interested in the ghosts of the White House, or alleged ghosts of the White House?
Sure. So as part of, actually, I will say the way I first got introduced to it is through my current office, where my office is. So the White House Historical Association offices are in the Decatur House, which is on Lafayette Square, just right around the corner from the White House. And it's actually supposed to be one of the most haunted buildings in Washington, D.C. And it was told to me very early on when I first started, just so you know, sometimes people hear banging if you're here late at night, or hear noises. So, you know, just a heads up. So that was really my first introduction. And then as I was digging through some of the back catalog of articles we have and some of the pictures we have in our program and online, I started seeing, you know, all these stories about the ghost stories in the White House and some of the people who had reported it. And so, you know, once you start, you can't stop, and you just got to keep reading until you figure out everything that's been seen and who has seen what, and what stories repeat themselves and perhaps have a little bit more seriousness to them.
You know, one of the things that happens in a lot of these ghost investigations is looking back at the history of the property. Were there any legends around the land of where the White House was built, or around Washington, D.C. itself before it became the capital of the United States?
So I don't know any ghost stories about the land that the White House was built on. However, I do know that the man who owned the land, David Burns, he owned a lot of land in Washington, D.C., or what became Washington, D.C., including sort of part of Lafayette Square, which is now right across Pennsylvania Avenue. And I guess on one of the corners, there was a graveyard before a number of other things were built there. And it seems that there's a reoccurring theme of sort of weird stuff happening on that land. There was a graveyard, then British soldiers camped out there during the War of 1812, and then Civil War soldiers camped there. So it seems to be there is definitely a recurring theme sort of in that area. But apparently David Burns wasn't really all that thrilled about giving over some of his land for the city. And he, in his lifetime, sort of resisted by continuing to plant crops up and down Pennsylvania Avenue, which I think is hilarious. And you know, like letting out his farm animals to graze. And so he got basically what was the original version of the cease and desist letter from Washington and the commissioners asking him, can you please stop planting crops in Pennsylvania Avenue? And so apparently one of the things that people have reported is that they see the ghost of David Burns in the White House, in particular in the yellow oval room, which is on the second floor, and that he has come back and several people have seen him.
Well, by a strange coincidence, I'm currently borrowing a truck from my friend David Burns. And I feel a little bit haunted as well. So
I keep thinking of Talking Heads, David Burns.
Oh, there's that David Burns as well.
Yeah.
It's just too common of a name.
If I don't return the truck, maybe he'll be burning down my house.
Like, there you go. Or he'll like plant crops in your yard or something.
There you go.
So it seems like a lot of ghost stories are linked to deaths that take place in a house. So how many people have died in the White House that you're aware of?
So, to my knowledge, only 11 people have died in the White House, which is actually kind of a shockingly small number given the people that have lived there and worked there over 200 plus years. So 8 presidents died while they were in office, but only 2, William Henry Harrison and Zachary Taylor, died in the actual house. And 5 children died while their parents were in office, but only Willie Lincoln actually died in the White House. And then 3 wives, Letitia Christian Tyler, Caroline Harrison, and Ellen Axon Wilson, all died in the home. And then a couple of other residents, a child of two of the slaves, actually, that Jefferson brought to the White House, an infant child, died in 1803. The father of Julia Dent Grant died. And then a couple of intruders in the 20th century who tried to either invade or attack the White House through automobiles were killed either by the Secret Service or in an accident.
Wow.
Wow, I'm really impressed with your knowledge of all the names and dates.
Oh, well, I will admit that I do have some notes here to prompt my memory. But,
no worries.
But what's really interesting, actually, I think about the White House is, you're right, usually ghost stories are affiliated with people who have died in the home. And that doesn't really seem to be the case with the White House. It seems like most of the ghost stories are either people who lived in the home at one point or wanted to be in the home and couldn't be, or were forced to leave early or something like that. So it's more about people and sort of their role in the space as opposed to death.
Still so difficult for me just as an Australian to think of the White House as a home as well. I mean, I tend to think of it on a much broader scope than just where the current president and his or her family are living. So it's just really, there's so much business taking place there, so much more than just people living there. So it is just interesting to think of it in terms of a home.
Yeah, absolutely. It wasn't really, honestly, until the 20th century, until Theodore Roosevelt added the addition of the first West Wing, that it actually really became such a business-like place. It really was first a home and sort of a social space for the president to entertain, you know, important visitors or people of state, but then also the American public. And so a lot of times people, when they moved in, really did struggle with the fact that it was supposed to be their home, but it was also a very public space because for a long time, especially early on, the bottom floor was just kind of open to visitors. And so there were just constantly people traipsing into the East Room and wanting to take souvenirs and, you know, cut little pieces out of the carpet or the drapes or, yeah, wait around to see if they could find the president, things like that. And the president had his office on usually on the second floor and would meet with his secretaries and his both his private secretaries and the department secretaries there. So, you know, it's really the space. It tells us so much about American history beyond sort of just the traditional politics that most people think about. It talks about diplomacy and, you know, social trends and customs. It talks about race relations and the economy and culture and all sorts of things in ways that one space doesn't usually do. So it's a really awesome avenue for studying history of all types.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Yeah, it's such an important and iconic thing now. I mean, there clearly was a time when it was just a small house. It's not as big as I thought it would be when I finally saw it, but
that's right.
It's huge in its sort of presence. Now, from a paranormal perspective, it is one of the few homes that's consistently been reported to speak, which I find is kind of amazing. I mean, there's hardly a day that goes by I don't hear that the White House reported this or the White House said that. It's practically a gossip. And that was a joke.
You know, it's interesting that it has become such a symbol of the government and such a symbol of the presidency in a way that, as you pointed out, it really wasn't for a long time. And now you're right, it's absolutely synonymous with the presidency. It's impossible to see it and not think of it in that way. And, you know, the image itself.
What's the most consistent activity, the paranormal activity that's reported on the property?
So I think the most consistent is probably something having to do with Lincoln, which makes sense. I mean, he's such a popular president and his death happened in such a tragic and striking sort of way. It also, you know, doesn't really help, or maybe it does, depending on what your perspective is, that Mrs. Lincoln, Mary Todd Lincoln, was very into spiritualism. And so she held regular seances at the White House and then at their summer residence at the Soldiers' Home. But many people have reported seeing Lincoln or even seeing his son, Willie. Mary Todd Lincoln thought that Willie's ghost visited her every night. Linda Bird Johnson Robb, who was President Johnson's daughter, reportedly saw him in the 1960s and had a conversation with him. But Lincoln apparently has come back time and time and time again. Actually, one of my very, very famous favorite stories, and one of the most famous, is Winston Churchill. He would repeatedly stay at the White House when he came to visit both Truman but first FDR. He and FDR were very close. I should say Franklin Delano Roosevelt. So when he would come to visit Roosevelt, he would stay in, initially he would stay in Lincoln's bedroom, which I should clarify for our listeners, Lincoln's bedroom was not actually a bedroom. Initially, it was his office and where he would have maps on the wall during the Civil War. And that became a bedroom later on. And it was referred to as Lincoln's bedroom. And Churchill used to stay there. And one time, apparently, he was taking a bath and Lincoln's ghost walked into the bathroom. And after that, he refused to stay in that bedroom suite and insisted upon staying in a different bedroom on future visits. But apparently First Lady Grace Coolidge and Queen Wilhelmina of the Netherlands also reportedly saw Lincoln. So he is probably the most frequently noted.
I also heard to that story that Winston Churchill wasn't wearing anything and was smoking a pipe. Is that true?
I think he was actually in the bathtub, but he frequently smoked. I think he actually smoked cigars. So he was probably, I mean, he frequently smoked. I think he was a chronic cigar smoker. So I think he was probably smoking a cigar in the bathtub and, you know, reading papers or whatever. And he apparently was very displeased about it because he said that no one would really want a ghost walking in when they were in the bathtub.
Yeah, it was not his finest hour.
No, it was not.
No, I also read that he said something along the lines of, well, I guess this puts me at a disadvantage or something like that, which sounds very Churchill to me.
Very Churchill.
Yeah. So with the phenomena that's reported, who is generally reporting it? Is it are the stories coming from staff or residents or visitors?
Some of both. Most of the reports come from either people who are living in the home, so family members or the presidents or staff that were there. So one of the most famous reportees. His name was Jeremiah Smith. He went by Jerry, and he worked in the White House for about 35 years. He started under Grant as a footman and sort of worked his way up to what he referred to as the official duster. And he would greet reporters when they would come to the White House, and he always had a good story for them and could tell a tall tale, and became so famous in print that they called him the Knight of the Feather Duster. And they loved going to speak with him when they, you know, had a deadline and they couldn't come up with a story. And so he, most of these stories, especially the Lincoln ones, are attributed back to Jerry Smith. He loved telling stories, and whether or not they were true is hard to say. But one of his more famous ones was when he was working for President Grant. Grant was really struggling to keep Nellie and her friends — Nellie was Grant's daughter — and her friends out of the attic. They kept trying to go up there and have a, you know, private place to play. And so Jerry Smith came up with a story that the noises she was hearing in the attic were actually the work of the devil. And he resided in the attic. And so those noises and the screeches that she was hearing were the devil. And it actually turns out that they found out later that the noises were from a very extensive rat problem. But it worked to keep Nellie out of the attic. So he was a very common reporter. He told lots of tales.
Going back to the Lincoln seance, in those, do we have any records of like what sort of things went on during those seances, or like what did they — I know his wife was very much a spiritualist. We've got the very famous ghost photo from, I think it was Mumler did that shot. I was just wondering if we know they happened, but do we know much about what happened during those experiences?
I don't know that we know too many details. I mean, I do think that they were, you know, reported on fairly widely, which sort of discredited her in the public's eyes, or made her seem perhaps a little bit more unstable. But I guess in the Midwest, especially in the 1840s, spiritualism was a very important and sort of widespread trend. She had suffered a lot of loss in her family, and after Willie died, she just became sort of incapacitated with grief. And so she really turned to the seances as a way to try to deal with that. And so I think she brought in some professionals, and it was she would hold them when they were out at soldiers' home. She would hold them out on the front porch at night. There were some reports of people that would go to visit and there would be candlelight on the front porch, but those are kind of the only details I know about that. And I do know that Lincoln occasionally attended, but he wasn't as taken with it. That was not how he coped with his grief.
Aren't there rumors too that the Reagans held seances, or at least Nancy Reagan? I believe she was interested in a lot of paranormal claims and would consult astrologers.
Yes, I've heard that too. I don't know of any specific details, but I do think she was very intrigued by the paranormal and was very interested in astrologists and that sort of trying to, you know, predict things and read out of sort of this realm in that way. But I don't know any of the particular details about, you know, who she turned to or what those details look like.
In the course of all this, have there ever been any ghost investigations of the property? I know that's probably been precluded by security by the time that became a popular activity, but I was just curious.
Certainly not in the 20th century. I think the Secret Service would put a kibosh on that. But I do know that, you know, the White House, depending on who's in it, has certainly sort of embraced this idea. The last year that President Obama was in office, they held sort of a ghost tour around Halloween, and they had first-person interpreters in the White House. And so some of the famous people that have been, you know, reported being seen, Thomas Jefferson, Abraham Lincoln, they had interpreters there, first person interpreters sort of dressed up as those people that are very convincing sells. I've seen some of them at different historic sites in the different rooms where they've been reported. And so that's sort of great fun, because it's a fun way for the president to sort of embrace this history and this story.
Definitely. And it's strange to think that there's a place where ghost adventures aren't welcome at all.
Yes, exactly. Well, it's, you know, the president has so many serious topics on his plate. It's nice to have one that's a little bit more fun in this way. Sure. There's actually some great videos of the different interpreters online. I think they're on ABC's website, and we have in the White House Historical Association's digital library, we have some photos as well.
Great. Great. And so we've talked a little bit about Abraham Lincoln and Winston Churchill. Could you tell us a few more sample ghost stories? I believe that Harry S. Truman either had sightings or has been seen.
Yeah, I think he saw some, he definitely reported seeing some ghosts. There are some great ones. So there are some famous people like John Tyler reportedly proposes to his second wife, Julia Gardner, over and over in, again in the Blue Room, which was where they held their wedding ceremony. William Henry Harrison was the first president to die in the White House. He apparently haunts the attic. One of my favorites, Abigail Adams, for those listeners who don't know this, the Adamses were actually the first people to move into the White House on November 1st, 1800. And it really wasn't quite finished yet. And so the East Room, which is now a beautiful sort of reception space where there's, if there's balls or dancing or concerts, it's in that space. It was sort of a shell of a room. But she didn't want to hang out the laundry in the backyard because it was very public. There was no gate. And so she would hang up the laundry in the East Room to dry when they were there in the house. And so to this day, contemporary staff sometimes report smelling wet laundry and lavender.
Wow.
Which I think is really amazing. Dolly Madison is probably one of the more social ghosts in Washington, D.C. She has apparently been seen overlooking the Rose Garden several times, but she's also been reportedly seen at the Octagon House, where she and James Madison lived after the White House was burned. And she's also been reportedly seen at the Cutts Madison House, where she lived after James Madison died, rocking in the rocking chairs on the front porch. So she was very social in life, and she's very social in death as well.
Now, it's funny because when I think about ghost stories, I usually think about isolation late at night, and then, you know, in that kind of weird sort of twilight space, that's when you run into your ghost experience. But I'm having a hard time imagining people being alone in the White House. It just seems like such a busy place.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, there are definitely some of those stories, too. So there are some of the ghosts that are sort of unknown or, you know, unknown figures are definitely more reported at night. So various people have seen a ghost of a British soldier walking around the grounds holding a torch, which I don't know if they say that sort of as a dig on the White House or just, you know, I don't know. I don't know what the purpose of that would be, but I think that's pretty funny. There have been a number of reports of a woman in a white gown that used to be seen in the old conservatory that no longer exists. So it was a beautiful maiden in a white dress at night. President Arthur, so Chester Arthur, was disturbed late one night by an old-haired white man ghost. And then there's one in particular that I think is pretty interesting. It never actually received a name. It was called The Thing. And it was a ghost of about a 15-year-old boy that really scared the domestic staff working in the Taft presidency. And in about 1911, people reported that when they were working on a paper over a desk or something at night, they felt like something was leaning over their shoulder to see what they were doing. And so many of the staff were talking about this, and Taft was getting so frustrated that he ordered his military aide, who was Major Archibald Butt, to tell his staff that the first person he heard talking about it was going to be fired because he was so tired of the staff talking about the thing. So sometimes it is definitely late at night and scary. One of the sadder tales, I think, that's been told is the ghost of Anna Surratt. So Anna Surratt's mother, Mary, was convicted of conspiring to assassinate Lincoln. And she went to the White House to beg Johnson for a pardon, and he refused to see her. And so she was the first woman that was executed by the United States government. And so people have reported that every July 7th, Anna returns and bangs on the gates of the doors and cries to see President Johnson or whatever president is in office. So that usually happens at night as well. And so that, I think, is one of the sadder stories.
What always makes me sad about that is I was just a kid, that they had made a TV movie about Dr. Mudd that had been involved in the conspiracy. He treated Booth after the assassination and therefore got sort of rounded up, but whether he was really involved or not, history seems to be pushing towards he wasn't, but he still served time. And,
yeah.
But I've always heard that the phrase, my name, your name will be Mud, was tied to that. But I've never had an opportunity to look it up. Now I'm reminded once again that I need to keep
it. We should look into it.
Yeah.
But I've never confirmed it. And the place that I think I first heard it was from the National Treasure movies. So I know that I can't take that as a source.
If you can't trust Nicolas Cage, I'm not sure who you can trust.
Exactly. So I'll have to look that up too.
Editorial note. It turns out that the idiom, your name will be Mud, actually shows up in print 20 years before the Lincoln assassination, and the claim that the idiom is related to Dr. Mud is merely folk etymology. It actually just means mud in the sense of your name will have the social standing of wet dirt, which is to say, very low standing indeed. And while I'm here, the movie I was referring to is the 1980 made-for-TV film The Ordeal of Dr. Mudd, which starred Dennis Weaver as Dr. Mudd. People my age will remember Weaver as the cowboy Detective McCloud from the Sunday Night Mystery TV shows. Also, the film had Richard Dysart playing Secretary of War under Lincoln, Edwin Stanton. And listeners probably know Dysart as Dr. Copper, the ill-fated medical man in John Carpenter's 1982 masterpiece, The Thing.
Well, I'd love to ask, Lindsay, have you had any personal experiences yourself?
I haven't. You know, I haven't. I've stayed at the Decatur House late at night, but I've been there with other people. And so I've heard that most of those stories tend to be when you're alone. And while I've had the pleasure of being in the White House, it is usually accompanied by a tour when I'm giving a tour and, talking to a group. So I unfortunately have not experienced any of those things. I think that I would really enjoy it if I did. I don't know that I would find, if I saw the ghost of Thomas Jefferson playing the violin in the Yellow Oval Room, which is something people have reported, I think I would be more intrigued than frightened by that.
So, is your job, is it, you're, I assume, sort of a, this is a nonpartisan, is it a government job?
It's a great question. So we are nonpartisan and nonprofit as well. We're entirely privately funded. So our job is really to tell the story of the home and the people in it, less from a political point of view and more from the view of private life looked like in the home, but also, the house's role on the public stage and in diplomacy and that kind of thing. And so, I mean, as I was trained as a political historian, so I certainly study the politics of the early republic. And, it's my good fortune that the guys that I write about are sort of, long dead. And so no one's going to get offended. But, we've really found that if we stay out of politics, then we can reach a much larger audience and share the history of the space and the importance of the space as the people's house and not really just as the president's house. We have a much greater ability to do that if we can sort of stay out of the political realm. So that's our goal as best as possible.
Ditto. So it's mostly just religion then? No,
yeah, that other super easy subject.
Are there, so you just mentioned the other buildings, that's one of the questions I had. Are you aware of other ghost lore, these big public spaces in D.C.?
Yeah, so there are a lot. I mean, there aren't too many. Unfortunately, D.C. was very late to the historic preservation movement, so there aren't as many old homes in D.C. as there are in places like Philadelphia or Boston, which is really unfortunate. But in some of the older homes like the Capitol or the Octagon House, which is just a few blocks from the White House, or the Cutts Madison House, which is one of the other historic homes on Lafayette Square that's been preserved, or even the site of what is now the Hay Adams Hotel. There used to be two really lovely townhomes there owned by the Hay and Adams families. And Marion Hooper Adams, she went by Clover, unfortunately, after a long history of family, a long family history of mental illness and suffering with a long history herself, she took her own life. And it really wasn't understood well at the time. And so apparently her ghost does haunt the Hay Adams Hotel. So lots of stuff sort of in that neighborhood. So many famous people have lived there and so many interesting things have happened that it's not really surprising that those stories would crop up.
Are there any ghost tours in the DC area?
There are. So there are some great ghost tours around, of course, around Halloween of D.C. And then there's also a really wonderful one in Old Town Alexandria, which is just across the river. And Old Town has a lot of really amazing old buildings. Alexandria itself is actually much older than D.C. It was a really important port in the 18th and 19th centuries. It was where George Washington would send all of his crops and his goods to sell things to. It has the longest running farmer's market in the history of the United States. So it has a lot of really old buildings, and it has a great ghost tour as well.
Aside from ghosts, are there any other sort of paranormal stories around the White House? I don't know what that would be exactly. Maybe curses or anything. We're just kind of just sort of gathering lore here at this point.
Sure. Yeah. No, I haven't really heard about any curses per se. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if there were, because there were so many people that wanted to be in it and weren't, you know, didn't get elected or were sort of booted out by elections. But I, you know, I do know that when Chester Arthur lost the, you know, when he left his office after his first term, his wife said, oh, we'll be back in 4 years. And sure enough, they were. But that's the closest thing that I've heard as some sort of curse or anything like that.
It's like a prophecy, right? Yeah.
Exactly.
Cool. I'd heard of the curse of, is it Tippecanoe, the one about the presidential curse, that there's an alleged pattern of death in office of presidents who are elected in years that are divisible by 20.
Really?
Yeah. I think that curse got broken, didn't it?
I hadn't heard that, but that's.
I don't mean like cast a spelling broke the curse. I mean just the numeric pattern broke.
Sure. I think it wasn't consistent in any way, but that there, you know, have been a number of presidents who've died in office or who've been assassinated or died of natural causes, and then a few assassination attempts too.
That's really interesting. Well, I will say that by and large, with the exception really of Theodore Roosevelt, generally the presidents who come into office after death have a much harder time than the presidents who were elected in. That's not really a curse. It's just sort of a political reality. But Roosevelt sort of escaped that because he was such a huge personality. But by and large, the ones that come into office in those sorts of really difficult conditions don't fare too well with the electorate going
forward. For clarification, you mean after the death of the previous president?
Yes.
I heard it that way at first as well.
I was like, I bet they would. I bet they would have a hard time. They can't get any of their plans implemented. It's tough. I'm sorry. That's terrible. But so I have a question. This is more about you, and that is, for you to be a historian writing your own book, how do you find time to do research for that kind of work? Is that all on your own time, or do they allow you in this job to pursue that sort of academic sideline? It's not sideline stuff, it's kind of core historian, but I mean...
Yeah, so it's some of both. The association is very encouraging of me doing my own scholarship and continuing to engage in academic and sort of other communities. They want me to, you know, engage with both the public and academic communities and groups for good reason, because then, you know, I can learn about other great scholarship that's being done and share my work with those people and build great relationships and partnerships and work on really cool projects with those people and get my work out and get the association's name out there as well. But, you know, part of it is also there are lots of things that come up in the day. So it does require a certain amount of, even though they definitely want me to do it, it requires some discipline. I know that I personally am better in the morning, so I try and carve out a little bit of time to write in the morning. I generally, if I have the choice, I try and do more meetings and that kind of thing in the afternoon to save my best and most productive hours for creating the really difficult content. And then a certain amount of it is just being really realistic about the circumstances, it's a little bit harder to go to archives that are super far away. Not that that is really necessary always. But, you know, I'm really, really fortunate that the work that I'm doing first on George Washington's cabinet and then with my second book is probably going to compare Adams and Jefferson's cabinets, because I'm just really intrigued by looking at the cabinet as an amazing way to look at relationships and political leadership and how decisions were made. But it's also a really integral part of private and work life in the White House. So kind of combines all of those things. I'm really, really grateful that there are incredible papers projects for all of those figures. And so the editing teams that put together these volumes of the papers, they do an incredible job, and historians are so indebted to them because it makes my work a lot easier, because a lot of it is online and a lot of it is in published volumes. And so there is a certain amount of, while I probably would pick these subjects anyway because it's where my heart lies, it does make it a little bit easier to do that sort of work in my office and not have to leave all the time.
Cool.
And now you have to do a book on ghosts in the White House as well.
I know. Now that I've dug up all this stuff, I'm going to have to write something about it.
Yeah, if no one's done it, I mean, that's a great opportunity.
Yeah, I don't think that there's a book. There were a couple of American University has a great master's program in public history. And so a couple of students put together sort of a proposed president's neighborhood ghost tour. But and there are some great articles on our website about ghost sightings in the White House. But I don't think anyone has actually written anything sizable about it.
I've watched over the past few years that a lot of historic sites have been picking up on this dark tourism sort of trend. And Gettysburg really seems to be embracing it. And it's interesting because it seems like it's kind of a sacrifice, because you're sort of embracing the supernatural, spooky side of things in an effort to drum up more visitors, but at also potentially the expense of losing the context of the more important historical real events that happen.
Yeah, I mean, I think that you're right. It's a really hard line to walk, because, you know, I think the idea is if we can meet people sort of in the middle and what their interests are, then maybe we can sort of open a conversation. And once we've sort of talked about the initial thing that brings them in, take it a little bit farther and, you know, introduce them to other types of topics. So it's the same concept, you know, behind the Hamilton musical. It has gotten so many people interested in American history, and they recognize that it's art. It's incredible art. I love it. I'm obsessed with it.
So are my kids.
It's so infectious. But most people understand that it's art. And so there are some things that it gets wrong. So if we take that as a starting point of, like, you and I both love this musical, that's fantastic, let's talk a little bit more about what happened, that's a great opportunity to bring new listeners and new readers and new lovers of history into the field. And so, you know, it is hard to walk that line and be really respectful of the serious things that have happened and the serious history. But also, you know, we don't want to do serious history and have no one read it, because that would be sort of foolish. And so if we can find a way to get people interested and then introduce them to some of these more serious concepts, I think that's a win for everyone.
It's a good gateway.
Absolutely.
You know, so I think we're trying to do that right now. We're trying to balance that whole, there's a real historical site there with a lot of amazing history. And then there's these spooky stories. And, you know, I think it feels to me like any kind of place that has this sort of emotional, cultural gravitas is going to, over time, accrue these kind of stories, because that's just what we do as humans. But
absolutely.
I find it so interesting.
The one thing that I would sort of mention that I think would be really incredible, and I don't know how to really get at this other than maybe some oral histories, is there were a lot of enslaved workers that were hired out. So their owners hired them out to the construction crews to build the White House. And then there were a lot of enslaved people that worked in the White House for the first 60 or so years. And I think that there are probably some really great stories there that haven't been told. And so if anyone is looking for an interesting subject to research or to dig into, that would be a great way to dig into the history. The association, we're starting a research initiative to try and bring out some of those stories in that community and really tell the full story of the White House in a way that it hasn't necessarily been done in the past. And so that is sort of our goal going forward, and I would encourage other people to dig into it as well.
Yeah, I hope that happens. It's very important.
Yes, it is. It's very.
I've watched online as people talked about the White House being built by slaves. And, you know, a lot of people don't know that or are in denial of it. And, you know,
I didn't know that.
Our history's complicated and a lot of it's really not good. So,
yeah, well, in Washington, you know, Washington, D.C. now, the way we think of it as this, you know, really international city, it was not that for a very long time. And it was initially very rural and there were a lot of farms. And then even up through the Civil War, it was a relatively small city and it was very Southern in its culture up until about the 1860s. And so it was absolutely a slave city. There were a lot of slaves there. There were slave auctions during when the White House was actually being built. A lot of the slaves lived in huts in Lafayette Square. So that's just a really important piece for people to know. And it doesn't mean, you know, that we can't still, you know, view the White House as the symbol of the nation. It's just important to know that there are, you know, all these different facets and we can study them and know all of them and they can all be true and be a part of our history.
It's always more complicated than we know. That's the thing. I think
yes.
History's
yes,
complicated.
Absolutely.
You know, it's like you love your mom, but your mom's complicated. Are you? You know, that,
it's so
like,
true.
Oh, my mom.
So true.
Well, not your mom, Karen. It's like, but it's a fascinating thing to me that the nuances of history and, you know, documenting it and contextualizing it, all of that stuff. It's I think it's so important for us to understand, because if you only know what's happening right now, there's that sort of fallacy of we live right now and everything's always been like this. No. Yes. My grandfather's 102. He knew people who fought the Civil War. He knew people who owned slaves.
One of the things that I think is amazing about, you know, the study of history is it shows us both how much has changed, especially, you know, the 20th century was such a tremendous period of technological innovation, you know, medicinal innovation, so many different things changed so much. And yet some things have also stayed the same. There are things that definitely sort of repeat themselves. Maybe history doesn't repeat itself, but it certainly has parallels. And so there are moments of anxiety, there are moments of tension, and that happens time and time again. And so it's really good to see both the change and then the things that, you know, sort of stay the same as well.
I hate it when people do these weird twisted takes on history where they're trying to give you some non-historical view based on their extremely fringe interpretation. So good historical research, primary sources, and sort of getting that other historian peer review that happens. I think that's all really, really important versus the sort of pop culture take. And so I'm glad that your group is out there and sort of preserving these probably difficult to capture bits of information, even if it's public life. I know there's a lot of efforts to sort of massage how people are remembered from an administration. So I'm sure when they're cleaning out from one administration to get ready for the next, there's a lot of concern around that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, we think that's really important too. We do try and, for the sake of, you know, staying out of the political context, we stick to a couple of administrations back and sort of wait for a little while to look at things. But that's, you know, you're right. It is so important. It's so important to have critical analysis. And one of, you know, the best skills about learning history is learning how to evaluate your evidence and to know what you're looking at. And that's just a really important skill. That analysis, I think, is something everyone can benefit from.
So, Lindsay, we've been talking mostly about ghosts today, but the question that we like to ask all of our guests is, what's your favorite monster?
So I've been giving this a lot of thought, and despite this conversation, I actually don't really like scary things. So I think my favorite monster is the Cookie Monster, because I love cookies and I loved baked goods, but I'm a total wuss otherwise. And so I think that is my favorite monster.
Well, we've never had the Cookie Monster before, so that's a good answer.
Well, good. I'm glad I could give something unique.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the show, Lindsay, and we just really appreciate you talking with us about this topic and being so lighthearted about it too, because a lot of famous places, they just don't like to talk about the folklore and these kinds of things.
Oh, sure. Yeah, no, this is fun. And I think, you know, it's a great way to share some White House history in a lighthearted way and let people know that there's great history out there to read about it. And thank you so much for having me.
And absolutely let us know when your book comes out or when it's available for pre-order. What do you know what the title is going to be?
Sure. It's The President's Cabinet, George Washington and the Creation of an American Institution.
Sweet.
Beautiful.
It is. It is. Yeah. And I did look up, it was the kitchen cabinet was actually a derogatory term used against President Andrew Jackson to describe his cabinet. So
that's right. Yeah. And it came up again with Kennedy.
Oh, really? Okay.
Uh-huh. Yeah, because Kennedy had sort of his official cabinet, and then he had a lot of sort of exterior advisors that he relied on. And
like
so
Marilyn
it was
Monroe.
Used
to- Exactly.
I was going to say some other people, but that too.
Monster Talk.
You've been listening to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith.
And I'm Karen Stolzner.
You just heard an interview with Lindsay Travinsky about ghosts of the White House. We thank Lindsay and her employer, the White House Historical Association, for her informative discussion. Monster Talk is an official podcast of Skeptic Magazine. The views expressed here are those of myself and my guests and don't necessarily reflect the opinions of Skeptic Magazine or the Skeptic Society. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Monster Talk. Each episode, we strive to bring you the very best in monster-related content with a focus on bringing scientific skepticism into the conversation. If you enjoy Monster Talk, we now have a variety of ways to support the show, all with convenient links at monstertalk.org/support. That's monstertalk.org/support. We have links there to our Patreon page as well as a donation button. Another great way to support the show is to buy books from our Amazon Monster Talk wish list, which directly helps us with our research. We love used books very much, so don't feel compelled to buy new ones, and we love Kindle so we can share our digital libraries with each other. And finally, without spending any money at all, you can support us by leaving a positive review at iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Positive reviews help keep us visible in iTunes, which is a great way to help us find new listeners. And please share our show on your favorite social media platforms. Monster Talk theme music is by Peach Stealing Monkeys.
For more skepticism? Want to learn the truth about the scientific controversies of our time? Then subscribe to Skeptic, the quarterly magazine Stephen Jay Gould called the best journal in the field. To subscribe, visit skeptic.com today.
Alexandria itself is actually much older than DC. It was a really important port in the 18th and 19th centuries.
But Alexandria also has a big zombie problem, I heard.
I have not heard the zombie problem. That's amazing. You'll have to tell me about that.